One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Would you have loved me if I'd never changed? If I'd been my true self?
Guess we'll never know.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I am David Chen, and joining me today, as usual, for this series covering Secret Invasion, he is the co-host of Remap Radio and the writer of Crossplay, a new Substack that you can find at patrickklepek.substack.com. Patrick Klepek, welcome back to Decoding TV.
I'm back. I'm still at Substack. I'm still here. Dave hasn't kicked me off yet, and so I'm ready to talk some more.
Despite my best efforts.
I know.
Despite my best efforts.
My monitor is attempting to turn off on me and also to try and kick me off, but I said, no, flicker away. Tornadoes are happening all around me, but nothing will stop me from talking about episodes 3 and 4 of Secret Invasion, Dave. You cannot stop me.
Indeed, indeed. Patrick is, you're in Chicago area, right? So that's what's causing.
I am, yes.
Well, anyway, today on Decoding TV, we are going to be discussing episodes 3 and 4 of Secret Invasion, currently streaming right now on Disney Plus. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. And find us on TikTok, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram, and Threads at Decoding TV. We are going to start by talking about non-spoilery overall thoughts about episodes 3 and 4. Then we're going to move into a full detailed recap and bring up any additional topics related to these episodes. So let's get into it, Patrick. Let's start by talking about overall thoughts. At this point, we are more than halfway through the show. Mm-hmm. And I think we have opinions on the show, right? Uh-huh. We have overall opinions on the show. So what do you think how do you think Secret Invasion is going so far? How do you think the Secret Invasion is going so far?
I think that the secret might be that nobody's watching. Well, I don't know if that's a secret. Maybe that's not a secret. I have to admit, I was really holding out hope, like a couple of the scenes from episode 2 between Rhodes and Fury that was maybe going to chart a path for, if not an amazing show, a show that would have enough strong scenes, enough character scenes, because it just became clear pretty early the show is not setting especially high stakes for itself. The show is not setting especially high consequences for the broader universe, and that can be fine. But then what are you doing with the rest of it? Justify your time here and your time with me. And my disappointment comes from the show having, in bullet point form, if you were to explain, here are some of the things we're going to explore in this show. I see the show walking up to that line where it could do some of those things, and then choosing, not even metaphorically, having characters walk out the door and like choose not to engage with those topics.
A character walks out the door at one point instead of...
Yes, when they say the most... having the most meaningful exchange between those characters about the subtext and the text of their relationship. Well, we don't have time for it in this 6-part show. I need to go do a poorly lit action scene with the president. I cannot stay at this table. I think that is where my disappointment lies. It's like, I don't want to get into spoilers, but like a allusion to that is deep fears of mine that I said, I really hope they don't do this one thing. Please don't do this one thing. They did the one thing, which I obviously, I don't know if Dan knew or was just like, of course they're going to do that. And it's like, please don't do it. And it did it. And I will say, it's hard for me to recommend this show to anyone, but like the most die, like, hey, are you fine with just looking at your phone and watching Nick Fury on screen every once in a while? Like, if that level of show, wow. I mean, look, brutal. you watch a lot of, I listen to your stuff. You watch a lot of reality. There are tiers of show. Is the show there to engage you at the highest level? Your phone is down. I am fully on board with everything that's happening. It's okay for a show to not be at that level, but also you should know what you're in for and what your level of engagement is. I just think this show rarely captures, demands, or requires that level of attention. And maybe sometimes that's a really high bar to ask of something like the MCU, but there are moments like the conversations between Vara and Fury that gesture at like a much more like, where's the entire episode set in 1998 right. about the two of them?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
They clearly got up to some adventures. Like, you telling me that she's got this clandestine group of Skrulls up to stuff and he's off finding Captain America and whatever. And that, like, you couldn't build a show about them in love with, like, it's right there. And I think that's my frustration, is the where it chooses to point its camera at is frequently some of the least interesting work that I want to see. And then it walks into the door quite literally to moments that I'd want to spend 25 minutes with. And we get a couple before the show says, we got that whole plot thing to deal with, though. That plot over there. Do you want to go back to the plot? I guess. And that's kind of where I'm at the show. And especially now as we get to episodes 5 and 6, which if we're following the arc of basically everything else in Marvel shows, Marvel movies, or just comic shows, or just action in general, we're trending towards the climax, which is a lot more shooting and powers and things of that nature. And it feels like we're going to leave behind even the little bits that I've been kind of grasping onto so far.
Agreed with most of what you said. The only thing I'm confused by is your point about there not being enough stakes. Oh, I guess the annihilation of the human species is not enough stakes for you, Patrick Klepek.
I don't believe them. That's what I mean. I don't believe them. I don't believe you. I don't mean to be as naive as Talos, who really shows his inability to grasp the seriousness of like the situation throughout this show. Just a complete disregard. Like, this character is just gutted throughout the conclusion of where we're at in the series. But that's it. It's like I don't believe the stakes of the show. You can tell me that humanity is at stake, but multiple times now, and I don't want to spoil how episode 4 ends, but we're getting repeats. There are 3 moments in this show that it tries to impart gravity with a character deploying a specific technique, let's call it. And in every instance, we've had, we haven't had a conversation about some of these occur over the episodes in question, but I didn't believe them any time. It was like, BS show. Like, I just know whatever you're telling me I'm supposed to be upset about, like, we're going to resolve it by the next episode. And so I guess I just don't grasp by or sit in with the stakes. And I'm primed to sort of be able to, like, I love these types of movies. I don't need a lot to get over the hump. Like, I can go wink, wink, nod, nod with the best of them. And I just don't think that this show is earning that from me. And once you lose those stakes, it's like the rest of the show doesn't have enough to support you on the way down.
I got an email this week, Patrick. Mm-hmm. That was someone, it was not a nice email from someone at decodingtv@gmail.com. And they basically said, hey, David Chen, why don't you choose people that will like the shows that you're reviewing? And I just want to make clear.
No.
I just want to make clear that when I was working with Patrick, like I didn't just Patrick Klepek was not randomly assigned Secret Invasion. We were like, hey, Patrick, you know, you're like, oh, I love MCU stuff. I've watched every single TV show.
100%.
I choose people who are inclined to like the thing, but if they don't like the thing, you know, like I can't control it. I can't control it. Right. That said, I will share my thoughts on these 2 episodes. I mean, I think it's clear that the show is not great at this point. But what it feels to me like a lot of these shows have in common, honestly, the show that this reminds me most of is Falcon and the Winter Soldier, or Captain America and the Winter Soldier, right? Where basically it has all these different ideas that it's chasing, you know? It's like, oh, we got to continue some of the MCU stuff, right? So Nick Fury, why was he in space and all that stuff? We got to continue that. But what about if shape-shifting aliens infiltrated the highest ranks of the government? Oh, that's interesting. What about Nick Fury's wife? Maybe Nick Fury was married this whole time. Ooh, Talos, he has an interesting, you know, it feels like it's like squirrel, like, oh, we have all these interesting things to go and try and figure out. Now, look, it is still a pleasure to see Samuel L. Jackson on screen. We get to see Samuel L. Jackson and Don Cheadle interact in the MCU, which basically nowhere else in the MCU provides us, as far as I understand, other than this show. So it's like, that's genuinely a pleasure. Episode 4 had some, in my opinion, solid action, you know? And so the show is not like irredeemable or anything like that.
No.
But I think the idea that it would like, you know, be one of the best MCU TV shows or whatever, like, it feels increasingly unlikely that that will happen at this point.
And I want to clarify. So, we did have that conversation ahead of me joining you to review this. And so I feel bad that I'm just leaning in.
No. I don't expect you to go ahead.
But what I want to say is this comes from a place of high expectation. I think there has been a trend in, if you look at like reviews, critical reviews of like, of Marvel stuff in the last 18 months, post Endgame especially, I think there has been a mixture of, yes, a real roller coaster of quality in terms of the product that is coming out, the stories that are being told, alongside a general just exhaustion from critics to want to even engage with these works, period. Because I think a tension that's occurring, and I can speak to this as someone that has only recently gotten on sort of like the crowdfunded like content creation business, for like to use the crassest possible terms.
Wow.
But when I worked at Vice and all my other stops along the way, I was thinking of traffic. I was thinking of SEO. And there is an inherent mandate to interact with Marvel comic book films because they are big. For a while, we're making a lot of money. Less so perhaps these days in a more consistent basis. But I do think though these works have been kind of become a punching bag, because a lot of critics are just tired of having to review them as a perfunctory part of their job. And I do not come from that world. I do not come to disliking or having a lot of disappointment with Secret Invasion from, well, gee, it's like I always have to wake up and talk to Dave Chen about the new Marvel thing. It's like, no, like I'm watching these shows already. Like, this is what my wife and I like. It is the reason we go to the movies is mostly to watch a new Marvel movie, because we got to get a babysitter and pay for tickets. It's a whole hubbub. It was one of our great disappointments to not go see the most recent, very good one of those, Guardians of the Galaxy, because my daughter got hand, foot, and mouth disease like right as that was happening. And so we had to cancel the babies. And so I just do want to like put a little context in the arc of me arriving at the show disappointing me. It's like, it's because I want this stuff to be great. And I can see a world where this could have been maybe not great, but much better than it was. And so I'm constantly grasping at like those little tendrils that I can in the show. And I think that it ends up expressing itself, I think, in line with a broader sort of like just tiredness with Marvel as a brand, as a franchise. But I personally do not come and arrive at that place from that same space.
Patrick Klepek comes not to tear Marvel down, but to raise it up.
Demand better.
Indeed. Well, okay. Those are our overall thoughts about these middle two episodes of Secret Invasion, episodes 3, Betrayed, and episode 4, Beloved.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome. Like, what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like, what if you have unexpected medical costs? United Healthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Let's get to a more detailed recap, which we will then follow up with some specific topics we may want to discuss. The topics may come up as part of the recap as well, but let's get into it. So we're not going to spoil episode 3. Let's start with episode 3, Betrayed. This episode opens with Gravik's group putting plans into motion for their next attack, infiltrating the UK's Royal Navy, attacking a United Nations plane via submarine, and sending the world into chaos. Gravik then reveals his secret research into Super Skrulls, a way of manipulating Skrull DNA to gain powers. We then venture into the past with a scene between a young Nick Fury and a Skrull named Vara, who will later become his wife. Back in the present, Fury and Vara spar over Fury's disappearance at the hand of Thanos and later his retreat into space. The events left Vara distraught, and while it's clear Vara's heart remains with Fury, her allegiances are unclear. While Gravik searches for a traitor in his group's midst, he meets up with Talos, who threatens to undermine Gravik's plans by revealing the presence of the Skrulls to the world. Gravik believes this would lead to the eradication of the Skrulls, while Talos believes humanity would understand the difference between good and bad Skrulls. While later having breakfast, a newly fired Fury approaches Talos and reluctantly asks for help. The two arrive at the home of a Skrull hiding as a Royal Navy officer seeking a launch termination code. The interrogation goes poorly, and Talos ultimately shoots the traitor Skrull when pressed about Gaia's loyalties. Talos calls Gaia for help, and after she retrieves the code from the memories of the human version of the officer in Gravik's base, the attack is aborted. Knowing she's about to be caught, Gaia attempts to flee before Gravik confronts her and shoots her in the chest. So that is where that episode ended. And I have to say, I watched episodes 3 and 4 straight through. So I did not spend a week wondering if Gaia was dead.
I didn't spend a week. I watched them as they came out, and I also did not spend a week wondering if Gaia was dead.
Well, that is your problem, Patrick Lepik. You know, this episode I thought was like the weaker of the two episodes.
I agree.
And I think one of the issues that this show is really having is in the buildup to some of these big set pieces. So the idea of episode 3 is you're infiltrating this guy's house. And he has like the nuclear launch, or he's giving the order. Or he's responsible for giving the order to fire the missile, blah, blah, blah. Is it just me, or did it feel like pretty freaking casual? Like the conversation that Nick Fury has with Olivia Colman's character, you know, he's like, hey, I need you to give me the, and she's like, okay, fine, yeah, I'll send it via email. Like it's, there's no like urgency or buildup to it. You know what I'm saying? Like
it's like, if this plane goes down, like the chaos element that Gravik is speaking is going to happen. And whatever she is dealing with, like she can't spare a couple agents to go meet up with them, like go on the back and they can a pincer move on the house.
She's like, yeah, whatever. It's fine. You know, like it's cool. Like, for some shows, this would be the culminating event of the season. Like yes. Building up to like this nuclear launch and figuring out a way to like stop it from happening. But instead it's just like, oh, another episode. Oh yeah. Okay. I guess we stopped that one. You know, good job. So I think that's a real problem with the show, is that you basically find out about the plan at the beginning of the episode, right? So like you're learning about the plan and then it is being resolved by the end of the episode, and it's supposed to have like world altering stakes. And
that's the show writ large, Dave. Like yeah. that is actually, for a mystery show, the show resolves a lot of its mysteries up front. Like in the premise, right? Like we learn so much about Gravik, his intentions, what the planet altering stakes are so early that like the like knockdown effect reveals that are happening as we go along. I mean, yes, would it be sort of silly to have a show that we're spending the whole time guessing like who is a Skrull? But that sounds like that might be more fun than where we've like ended up. And I just feel like the show, in some ways, it wanted to like reveal Gravik and the intention of Gravik up front, make them a central character from the beginning, as opposed to like a big bad to be revealed behind a curtain later. And I get that, but we also don't spend enough time with Gravik and the base and the other characters to really... This show through Talos is attempting to argue, if they, like, the show has like a broader sort of like theme that it's like really like it exploring through Talos, is can the Skrulls and humans get along? And obviously Gravik is saying, no, we should just take this planet for ourselves. And Talos believes, I think rather naively, that there's a path forward here. And if you're going to do a perspective show, like, I need more time understanding the perspective of Gravik. And the time that we do spend with him and his intentions is more or less just around like a mustache twirling, like, time to destroy the world with my super Skrulls, as opposed to is a very understandable, maybe not killing 2,000 people in a Paris attack understandable, but understandable tension with people who have been asked to work for the American government under a different skin. They cannot even be their real selves.
Yeah.
And to do that for decades under the promise of being accepted or at least sent somewhere where they can build their own home and society. And it's so easy to imagine being in the writer's room and in the same way that you're talking about all these threads we can pull on. It's like, that sounds like really rich textual territory for a television show. That would mm-hmm. would just be surface level premise for a movie to get you to the MacGuffin. And here, it's like I can describe all of these interesting angles, and I just don't feel like they end up getting explored. And that ends up being, I think, undercutting. All right, I almost wrote it in the write-up that I gave to you, and here's yet another plan to sow chaos from Gravik, because like that is, yeah. There is a bit of like a chaos of the week element.
Yes.
To it.
Yes. They made it into a procedural. Like it's a Gravik's plan of the week, basically.
Yeah.
Which is right, I don't think is a good approach for this kind of thing, right?
No, and like the fact that the Gaia is like immediately revealed to, in episode 4, like not like they're undercutting Gravik even as like this evil like villain. Like I just don't buy him. I don't buy his plan. And because of the formulaic nair of the sort of like chaos of the week, well, how are our heroes going to get out of it this time? And it's like, well, of course they get out of the jam. And so I just don't buy a lot of that. And also, like, we relate it to even understanding their perspectives. I wish we spent more time seeing the infiltration element, like the whole notion of like being a Skrull, like getting your way into the government. That seems like that could be interesting and tense. And we get basically none of that. It's sort of just a magic plot device to just insert them into places where they can execute their plan, as opposed to seeing any sort of the insertion element of that. Like, what, how are they getting the bodies out? Like,
well,
you know,
I think the approach can be best summarized by the scene early in the episode where the Skrulls are in the car and one of them says, time to transform, and then cut to they have been transformed. And it's like, I actually wrote down in my notes, I was like, oh, that's a nice way to save money on the transformations.
You can just say, I do think Dan was right in the previous episode that you can almost feel the writers and the actors finding ways to not want to sit in the makeup chair for what was clearly must be just an enormous amount of work.
Yeah, enormous.
Especially that scene in episode 2 when Gravik is presenting his plan to the council and they're, you know, who's a human? Like, why are they not in their Skrull like forms when they're talking? Like they're in the council. Why are we in our human forms? And it's probably because they don't want to do an entire day's worth of shooting in that makeup.
Well, I mean, to be fair, they do explain. There is an in-universe explanation for it, which is in the first episode, they're like, oh, we keep our human forms because that makes it easier to stay in them or whatever, you know, so.
Okay.
You
know. All right. Yeah. Sure. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So okay. You right, you're right. You got me. You got me.
I got you.
Undercut.
I am monitoring the canonical aspects of this so closely, Patrick. All right. There's much more to discuss in episode 4, so let's get to that. Episode 4, Beloved. Or Beloved. Gaia is revealed to have previously stolen the Super Skrull DNA, allowing her body to heal. So let's just stop. Let's pause right there. Boy, what a fake out. They faked you out, Patrick, huh? They faked you out.
You know, in episode one, when the death occurs at the end of that with Hill, it's really dramatic. Like they're really hammering Hill. Hammering home.
Yeah.
That Hill, like when they do doing like an overhead shot, slowly come out, the music is swelling. You know, yes, like this is a comic book franchise. Anybody can come back. But they did seem to be really trying to impart to you, the audience member, like, look at that dead body. Like, we're giving you a big panning shot of that.
Yeah.
And trying to impart like some gravity to the moment, even though obviously by existing in this universe, the watcher is always going to be thinking, well, couldn't they come back because of XYZ? And the shots they do here, we saw her go down, my wife and looked at each other. Well, she's clearly just going to get up again the next.
Really? Wow. You didn't buy it for a second.
Now, yeah. I mean, that's also the problem of, like, you know, you mentioned before that Emilia Clarke has not really been in much since Game of Thrones. Like, well, they're not just going to shoot her on the side of the road in
episode three.
Would have been bold.
Would have been bold.
It's not what they did. It also would have been poor storytelling. It was like, I feel like this character, if you're going to have her here, has more to say. And I do think they set her up with some interesting tension with her father. Whether that pays off is unclear to me. I think that's something we'll see in episodes 5 and 6. But yeah, I was just, she seemed very primed for, she's just going to get up for X, Y, Z reason. And so I didn't buy into any of the tension at episode 3. And so I wasn't even mad at the beginning of episode 4. It was more just, yeah, of course. Like, of course she's still going to be here doing something else.
All right. So we jump to 2012, aka the same year as the Battle of New York depicted in the original Avengers movie. At dinner, Vara teases Fury about what happened before the two express their love for one another while discussing a book of poems by Raymond Carver. Side note, by the way, wasn't clear to me if they were married at this point, right? Or if they're still courting or whatever. But yeah, didn't know if you had a different vibe. Back in the present, Vara meets with James Rhodes at a church service where we learn, whoa, plot twist. Rhodes has been a Skrull for an undetermined amount of time and tasks Vara with killing Fury. So first of all, I just want to say, let's give props where props are due. The Skrull version of Rhodes, it was taking a shower in the episode. And I was like, wow, the makeup is good. Like, I can imagine it being difficult to have makeup for Skrulls that is able to survive water. So good job on the makeup show. That was my reaction to that scene. But yeah, apparently Rhodes has been a Skrull for how long? Like, who knows? We know that Skrulls can kill people and take over their lives. So was Rhodes always a Skrull? Was he a Skrull for the last X years?
Yeah.
You know,
like, I have no idea. Unclear, I assume they're sort of setting up, obviously they could kill someone and assume, their face, their body, their form. But because, like, so often the show is like referencing back to this base full of humans that are like on the, like, whatever stasis pods that they're in, and then you can access their memories through a hand portal sort of device. I assume he's just there, like in that rack, and we just that is just not a shot that we have seen in the show.
I see. So you think like Don Cheadle, real Don Cheadle Rhodes, is somewhere in some kind of rack somewhere?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. I don't think he's dead.
Interesting. Interesting.
Perhaps. I mean, I assume he has that Armored Wars movie that's coming in the next couple of years. And I assume Skrull Rhodes is not the star of that, though that would be a bold turn to just have an entire film with a Skrull version of that character. But I will say, looking, even though I remain disappointed that the first time we get Samuel Jackson and Don Cheadle acting off one another, it is with a like not non-Rhodes version of that character, given the kinds of things those characters are talking about, like the history of black men and black power, is just someone that conversation.
In our last episode, didn't you say, hey, if Rhodes turns out to be a Skrull, that completely undermines the potency of the conversation they had, right?
If I recall it does. Correctly. And I continue to feel that, like, we have these two powerful black actors like talking about earning black power. And, like, what do you do with that? And it's like, well, but he was a green guy all along. You know, putting that aside, which I am.
Unless he's been Rhodes for like decades, which is like possible.
That's true. In this world, that is, right? That is, I guess.
And then it's
true.
Like, then it's like he needs to navigate being a black man and also a Skrull for many, many years. So, but it's unclear. It's unclear.
I feel like the first tell the show is giving us that is probably not the case was when Rhodes goes to that meeting with the other countries to explain Fury and Hill being in Paris. And he has that moment where it's like the Netherlands or someone is mouthing off to him and he turns around. And he's like, I'm going to get in the war suit and like mess that lady up. There's a line that
he threatens to bomb Slovakia, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. And that felt aggressive. And I granted, like, Cheadle has played that character being like kind of like he's capable of cracking jokes, but that seemed a little like, huh, like you're saying that in an official setting in which like clearly people could probably hear you. It wasn't like it was just off mic. And I sort of took that to maybe mean, is that the mask sort of slipping on that character for the, but I think it would be more interesting if it was a Skrull assuming Rhodes for many, many films.
Yeah.
Like of this is a Skrull. Like that will be a worthwhile turn for that character. And I think would, to your point, help massage my own uncomfortableness with like the way like that conversation with Fury and Rhodes, because then it still has weight if this person has had to assume like and work through all these prejudices around them as a result of assuming that face.
Absolutely. Does the show explain that to us? Not yet. It's possible we'll get an explanation by the end of the season.
I hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Also, I loved that I'm a sucker for Raymond Carver, man. I was like, and when I was watching this, I was like, wow, this is really giving us. When I was watching Vara and Nick Fury interact in the past, I was thinking to myself, wow, this is really giving us a look into what an alternate version of this show would have been. You know,
yes.
Where it's like, imagine if it was just conversations with Fury and Vara throughout the year. Like, if that's the whole show, I would have been super happy with that. That's like, oh, that's
just make it a one-off limited series. The episodes are 8 minutes long. It's just them at a coffee shop.
Doesn't even be 8 minutes, but it's like, it can be like play-like, you know? It's just like, hey, this is like a chamber piece with Vara. Now, no one, like, very few people would watch that, but here's the thing. Are people
watching that show? Yeah, we have a lot to talk about.
Absolutely. Are people really watching Secret Invasion in its current form is the question, you know? Like, anyone quoting Raymond Carver, I think these two actors have a lot great chemistry with each other. So
absolutely.
So I love the work they're doing. Okay. Back in the present, Vara meets with James Rhodes, and we learn that he tasks Vara with killing Fury, and it's like, the problem with this whole plot is, you know, we can get into this more later, is I think we are given tantalizingly few snapshots of Fury and Vara's past. And so, let's get into it later. We'll get into it later when we get to that point when she needs to actually betray him. Okay, so elsewhere, Gravik reveals Gaia is the mole and she's dead. And he moves forward with yet another plan to sow chaos. Pretend to be the Russians and assassinate
the
Americans.
There's where I put the yet another. I knew I had it in there somewhere.
Yet another plan to sow chaos. Pretend to be the Russians and assassinate the American president. Let's pause for a moment. And I want to say that... You ever watch 24, the Kiefer Sutherland show?
At one of my all-time favorite shows. Got to go to the 24 press event for the show. Got to meet Kiefer Sutherland. And ask him as I was turning 21 what I should have for my first official drink for my birthday. He paused for a long time, told this story about a drink that he had seen in the old like 50s Batman show that Batman and Robin would drink. And he begged his mom over and over to get it for him. And she wouldn't, because she was like, it's disgusting. I know they drink it in the show, but you're not. And finally, his mother relented, went and got it, brought it home, and it was disgusting, and he hated it. And so he looks at me, he's like, this is all to say, drinking is very personal. You're going to have to kind of figure it out for yourself, just like anything else in life. And then he pauses again and goes, but whiskey. I was like, oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sutherland.
Look, 24, in my opinion, is a very conservative leaning show. Like
100%.
There's a very like George W. Bush ideology embedded in that show.
Pro torture.
Yeah, very, very pro torture. But here's how a given season of 24 was structured. Okay. You'd have a terrorist attack about to go off within like the next 8 to 12 hours. Right. Each season was in real time. So every episode was 1 hour. Can you believe they used to make 24 of these a year, Patrick Klepek?
No. Right? I mean, they were, you must have been shooting 3/4 of the year just to put those out.
And like every episode was in real time. So every episode represented 1 hour. And for the most part, it worked, like in terms of, hey, you have 1 hour to do this task. And they had multiple, they had an A plot, a B plot, sometimes even a C plot each episode. But what I really appreciated about 24 was sometime in around the 8 to 12 to 14 hour mark each season, Kiefer Sutherland would solve the problem. Like he would, he would, because it's like he had, there's a terrorist attack and they know that they can't like extend out that attack for a full 24 hours. So he needs to solve the problem. And then, oh, whoop, turns out there is another bomb, Patrick. Right? that is always what happened. Like 2/3 of the season is like, oh my God, there's another bomb. We're going to spend the next 8 hours trying to fix the other bomb. Right?
And that's, I couldn't wait. I was like, I'm so glad there's another bomb.
they have two bombs going off within 24 hours. That's what it is, right? That's what 24 is. I could not help but think of 24 when watching Secret Invasion because Gravik has, in the first four episodes, three distinct terror plots, right? One is to blow up that Moscow public square where he killed, again, shockingly high number of people, 3,000. Then there's the launching the missile at the UN delegation plane. And now there's killing the American president. So he's really ramping up to the final boss level. But I have nothing, I have no opposition to the concept of like a guy has multiple terror plans, like in the show's universe. But the buildup, Patrick, right? Like for 24, you'd have literally 14 hours of buildup for one of those plots. Right.
And you spend so much time with the villains and the B and the C characters. I mean, like 24 is a show that gets lauded, you know, appropriately for its ability to like build tension for an action show that had constant commercials. that's difficult to do. But it also had like pretty meaningful character development for like all of its characters up and down the spectrum. Like I can tell you personal feelings about multiple presidents in that show. I think it's an overlooked part of what made that show work within that structure that it was operating in.
Yeah. And I think it's a real challenge that this show has of making, it's like we find out, oh, he's planning to kill the president. All right. And then by the end of the episode, the thing is...
do it like the Russians do. Like, what are you...
But do it like the... We're going to dress like them. We're going to talk like them. Although Gravik's not going to change his appearance. That might have helped a little bit. But
and also, if any of their soldiers die, they turn into green goblins. But you know what I mean? Like, literally, if one of Gravik's soldiers dies... All of a sudden, there's a green alien on the battlefield. I feel like that would raise some questions about this event and the chaos that it might create.
You know, to quote Kendall Roy, it's a high wire act on a straight razor, I think. You know, like, clearly the order of difficulty is very hard. But, hey, Patrick Klepek, Gravik does not make plans to sow chaos and destruction because they are easy. He makes plans to sow chaos and destruction because they are hard. So putting that out there. Okay. But yeah, not enough buildup to any one of these plans, you know, like in my opinion, every episode is just like, hey, here's a plan. And it's done. And here's a way we're going to get Nick Fury on site of that. You know, like that's what it is. So, yeah.
Yeah, the way they get him there is off. It's very convenient in retrospect. Yeah, I didn't really put all, you know, now that you lay it out that way, Dave, like it does seem all a little silly.
Yeah. Well, he has different. To be fair, the show does make up creative ways for him to be on site. So, like,
yeah, I actually thought the way they get Fury and Talos to this site. Look, throw the logic out, but like, it's fun. Like, it was a very enjoyable way to get them there.
In the first episode, he plants a bug in Olivia Colman's office.
And when she's so mad taking it, that was a good payoff. Like, I did enjoy her futzing with that and being mad after she discovered it was like,
that was nice.
In a show with not a ton of like setup and payoffs. Right. Like, that was a pretty good low stakes one.
In the third episode, she sends Nick Fury an email with the location of the terrorist attack. So that's how he gets to it in the third episode.
Encrypted, I hope. You know, end to end.
And in the fourth episode, he implants a scroll with tracking liquid, basically, is what happens, right, in the in the fourth episode. So, you know, it's making up different ways for him to figure out a way to be on site when each of these terrorist attacks occur. I will say, I understand why people are suspicious of Nick Fury, who conveniently happens to be on site whenever like a major terrorist attack is about to unfold. So even though he's trying to stop it, guys, he's not part of it. Mm-hmm. Okay. In a conversation between newly healed Gaia and Talos, Gaia asks her father what she plans to do about Fury's failed plans to provide the Skrulls with a new home. At which point Talos argues that taking down Gravik will give them leverage with the humans. Maybe I think it might be Talos, by the way. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing this. At which point, Talos argues that taking down Gravik will give them leverage with the humans to ask for favor. Amnesty. Gaia rejects Talos' naive plan for peace and walks away. I just want to say Talos' plan sucks. Like,
what a dumbass. Like, what are we doing here? Like,
well, it's not even that the plan is bad. It's just that it literally. When the performance is like he extemporized the plan, right? She's like, okay, what's your plan? And he's like, okay, well, gonna stop a bunch of these terrorist attacks. And then when I tell the president, hey, look at all these terrorist attacks,
owe me a favor.
He's gonna owe me one. And it's like, what are you talking about, dude? Like, I, as the viewer, am not even convinced by what you're saying.
Like,
so
Ben Mendelsohn can only do so much, Dave. He is capable of selling. Like, I watched him, you know, hunt down, you know, a creature of the dark in, oh, it was the HBO show he was in, the King one. The Outsider. Great show.
Outsider. Oh, amazing show.
Love The Outsider. And it made me so excited for him to be in the Marvel universe because I was like, oh man, you're really good at this genre stuff. Like, you can just say whatever. And I'm like, uh-huh, I believe you. And he could not. I was laughing. What are you laughing at? I was like, are you watching the scene?
It looks like, he literally like made it up on the spot. He's like, what's your plan? And he's like, okay, well, we'll start by doing, and I'm like, what is this? Like,
he does that, you know, he has a much more aggressive version of that when he has the conversation with Gravik in the museum in which they discuss, hey, like, if you can go forward with whatever plan you want, you go get so another chaos, but like, I'm going
so
to tell.
Chaos. Go to the chaos factory and pick up another chaos on the way home.
I know, there's a lot happening in that research back at the base. I don't know. There's a whole line of chaos happening. And, you know, he says, like, I will just reveal there's a million of us here. But granted, in that conversation, Gravik set up as the villain, even though they're trying to do like shades of like, you can understand his position. He's like, you will create a genocide. They will just hunt us down and eradicate us. And then he says, Talos says, well, I mean, they'll know who the good ones are, like me. And they're like, on paper, I can understand like having this perspective, this like naive sort of like person who has assimilated that has found Fury and believes it is possible for their people to fully assimilate. Or at least integrate, like, by adopting the faces of their hosts, as he keeps calling them, and find a way to exist alongside them. And I keep waiting for that to get chipped away, because it seems like that's an ideology that the whole show is basically saying over and over. That is untenable. Like, it is maybe possible for you to live here, but, like, to act as though it won't be with meaningful tension is naive. And you should have enough evidence at this point that is not possible. And so for this character, especially where we end up with them at the end of four, like, if that truly is the end of the line for this character, that's a bummer place for their arc to end. And then I guess be picked up by Gaia, who in some way, she has sympathies for her father, but disagrees with his intentions on how to play it out. But then Gravik is too far. So centrist Gaia, where do we end up with you? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think the politics of the show are really challenging in a bad way. I don't mean challenging like I'm challenged by them. I think they're not great. There's a great video that I will link to in the podcast show notes that I also sent to you this week about how the show kind of traffics in rather anti-Semitic tropes, specifically the idea that a group of shape-shifting aliens have infiltrated the highest levels of the government and are controlling world events.
Come on, I've never heard that one before.
That is a combination. That is a combination of multiple, like anti-Semitic. Like that's the problem, is that they combine two anti-Semitic tropes together.
Yep.
You know, if it was just one, it's like, oh, maybe that was that would still be bad, but it's like, oh, yeah. Like maybe that was an accident or something, but it's
or
like
demonstrate you know what you're doing with that, right?
Right, right, like, exactly. Like, they're like, oh, we're invoking it and we're subverting it, which is what Captain Marvel did, in my opinion.
Right.
It's like, correct. Hey, the shape-shifting aliens, you think they're bad? They're actually the good guys. Like that was, but the idea that they're mixing both of them together in this, and the problem is that Marvel in general and certainly Marvel TV shows rarely have a more complex ideology than bad guys versus good guys, right? Like Gravik is bad and evil, and Ben Mendelsohn is good and Nick Fury is good, and maybe Gaia is a little bit in between, but she's eventually going to come to the Ben Mendelsohn.
Yeah, we know she's going to work with Fury. If her father truly is dead, then like she is the stand-in character for that role, who maybe would be more she'd pick up a gun alongside Fury a little more than her father might. But I mean, the Marvel universe in general has appropriated complexity frequently thematically in order to give the appearance of a more complicated work than it is. And when it's doing that knowingly, it can be okay. But, and I think Black Panther is like the rare example of a film. I think its politics at the end can get pretty complicated, but like it knows what it's playing with,
yes,
and it's playing with it with intentionality. And then you can disagree on, you know, where it lands. And that's totally
fair. You can disagree on, you know, whether a movie called Black Panther should have ended with a CIA guy being a hero of the film, you know, like,
yeah, that and like opening like an education district, like, and like that. Like, right, I mean, there's
right.
Like,
yeah, there's a lot you can, there's a lot you can mess with, but
it's a choice. And it's like, I understand, I can see the through line from the argument that it's making in the politics of its work here, that it does to feel like it's just thematic appropriation to give the appearance of complexity without fully working through the implications of that. It doesn't have an opinion on any of these things. It's more just, it's much like when people, like, and I love The Winter Soldier, right? But like calling that like a Cold War spy thriller, like you're just appropriating like a more complex genre to explain like just a really well done action film. And that's fine. And I just feel like that it gets into really complicated territory when you're talking about exactly what you're talking about, Dave, where it's like, hey, it's one thing to like, kind of like, appropriate complexity of genres and like plot structure.
Right.
But when you start talking like depictions of people that are like deeply coded in conspiracy theory and hate, you know, it's very easy for your show to then end up appropriated by the folks who would look at that as, and I haven't seen a lot of, you know, example of that happening.
Yeah,
with Secret Invasion,
I haven't either, but I love the concept of this cultural appropriation and complexity appropriation. Or thematic appropriation. It's like we're borrowing the appearance of feeling like we're complicated, but we're not really. And that's the problem, is like Marvel is telling relatively simple stories in a very, very complex world. So far, there's little evidence that this show wants to engage with the kind of complexity that it's introducing with this idea that there's shape-shifting aliens infiltrating the highest levels of government, right? So, so that's... That I'll just say it makes for very awkward viewing because you're dealing with a show that has these like very heavy tropes that have been deployed in horrifying ways before, but it doesn't seem to even know that that's the case. It reminds me, you know, very different situation, but it reminds me of I read an essay once about like Danny Boyle's Yesterday, which is about this movie that where somebody wakes up and he's the only person that knows that the Beatles existed. So he tries to like recreate all the Beatles' songs. But it's like if the Beatles never existed, literally the entire pop culture landscape would be different. Like the way mm-hmm. The music industrial industry would be different. And it's like the movie doesn't address any of those things at all. And it's like it's and the way the essay, I think it was in the New Yorker, put it was like, it's not even that it doesn't answer the questions. It doesn't even feel like it knows that it asked the question. Right? Like, that's kind of how I feel about the show. It's like, yeah. it doesn't even feel like it knows that it has presented a complex and problematic situation, you know? Like, anyway. So we'll see. Maybe it's all going to land it in the end, Patrick. But I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think it's going to land that particular plot line in a.
No, I think not.
But yeah, I think we'll all see where this is going. Right? You put it well. Guy is going to become she's going to be so moved by the death of her father that she's going to go over to Ben Mendelsohn's side, and it's going to be again like good versus evil. You know, there's the good guys, the bad guy. Gravik is bad. He wants to kill too many people so he can have a homeland, and that's bad, you know? Which, again, pretty echoes of the real world in there that feel very uncomfortable to me.
One thing that's not – that it goes – it's just mentioned as a throwaway, but in the scene in episode 2 between if you're in Talos, there's mention of when Talos puts out a call for the rest of his people to come to Earth, wherever they've been hiding in different corners. There's also mention that, like, there is like a society or like some people have stayed in some other place. I'm forgetting exactly how it's described, but like there is people scattered and hidden, and then some people have like stopped in one tribe or like one area. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of goes unremarked on. And I'm curious, especially in given that so much of this is about a home. It's like, all right, well, if there is like one place, maybe it's not a planet, but clearly some people have aligned themselves with some part of the Skrulls to try and build something. I don't know, it's all that stuff that I feel like the show is just not giving us enough just foundational information of like the basic whys of how we've arrived here. I think that makes it hard to buy into the various arguments from the various factions of just, okay, but what, like, there are basic questions I think just haven't been answered about how we even arrive at this moment, even at the end of episode 4, that then makes it hard for me to care too much about the arguments each of the sides are making, because I feel like they're making them with information that I, as the viewer, do not have.
Well, speaking of not giving us enough foundational information, after the Talos Gaia scene, Fury heads home to confront Vara. In a tense exchange of love, disappointment, and apologies, the two fire guns at each other simultaneously, and both of them purposely miss. The two of them part ways, with Vara asking if Fury would have loved her if they'd been together in her original form. Guess we'll never know, he says. Let's pause for a moment, talk about the Vara situation. This feels like the biggest missed opportunity of the show for me, because it's like, absolutely. I think these two actors have such great chemistry together, and it's like, oh man, like, what would it have been like to be married to Nick Fury for decades, where like, he's trying to save the world, he's married to a Skrull, like, why did he want to marry a Skrull in the first place? And like, was it just because she liked Raymond Carver poems? You know, like all this stuff. And it's like, there's all these like rich questions there. So that at the end, when it's like, first of all, we barely even understand why Vara needs to kill Nick Fury, as far as I can tell, right? Like,
right.
Rhodes as a Skrull, apparently she's like working for Gravik, or like Gravik has her under control. Rhodes is working for Gravik too. Rhodes orders her to kill Nick Fury, right? And it's like, okay, I guess I can fill in some bit of a backstory there about like why she's involved with Gravik and stuff. But like, how long back did that go? You know, she's been with Nick Fury for decades now. So did she just recently? Anyway, whatever. So I'm not going to put more thought into it than the show. So then, then it's like, okay, so then she needs to decide whether or not to kill this person that she's been with. It honestly reminded me, I brought this example up a couple times recently, Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. You're introduced to Ray Winstone's character in the, like, one of the opening scenes of the film, and literally 10 minutes later, he betrays Indiana Jones. And that betrayal has no emotional impact at all, because you just met this guy. Like, why do you care if they? It'd be different if, like, you know, they brought Short Round back and then Short Round betrayed it, and it's like, oh wow, they've known each other for decades and we saw that before, you know, like, but we've just met this guy. And similarly, I feel like we just met Vara like a couple episodes ago. We've gotten snapshots of her relationship with Fury, but it left me more confused than really feel like it left me more like, what am I supposed to feel about Vara than feeling like, oh wow, what a big moment that Vara chooses not to kill Nick Fury. What did you think, Patrick?
Well, in many ways, we've just met Fury, right? Like, it's called Secret Invasion, but yeah. it is really a Nick Fury show. Like, Nick Fury has been just a chessboard piece, like, mm-hmm. in yeah. the Marvel franchise. Like, it's just been it's someone who gets the Avengers in the places they need to be to do the things that they need to do. And Samuel Jackson, by pure gravitas, is able to just imbue that with, like, a lot of weight, because that's what comes with, you know, casting an actor like Samuel Jackson, that sort of like imparts more than what is actually written into the character right. and depicted on screen. And here, like, man, it's so easy to imagine, like, and they even set up the structure with the scene in the cafe with the poem where he's coming off like the Battle of New York. And like, there's a newspaper referencing it, and they kind of like playfully talk about his like maybe yeah. or maybe not involvement. And it's so easy to imagine like a 40-minute episode that is just him walking in the door after being part of some world altering event. And they playfully talk about it or don't, and then just go on with their lives. And this is like his rest stop in between him constantly being involved in plots involving saving the world / universe. And the idea that you could just do 3 or 4 of those and like have these moments with these characters where he's able to decompress, talk about all the stress of his job, and give some interiority to this character and the weight that they must carry with the job that they have. And it's like you get it all bottled up in this one moment, and then the show crumples it up in the trash and goes, like, almost like it's an idea in a writer's room. And it's like, yeah. Well, that was nice. Time to move on.
What's so odd to me is the people who made the show seem to understand.
Yeah.
We need to know what their relationship was like. So they get that we can't just have Vara betraying Nick Fury like right out the gate. Because if they did, then so it's like, okay, so we're going to give you some flashbacks. But it's like, all right, I appreciate that you understood we needed more than nothing. But I don't know that the flashbacks are quite enough. The flashbacks and the little present day stuff we get, I don't know that that's quite enough to establish like,
because the relationship is so complex. It is not a... It's more than just a relationship that is built on like someone assuming the identity of someone else, right? We get the reveal of
Is like a really cool idea, you know.
Absolutely, I loved that. That is probably in a show that doesn't have a ton of things that you would sit with and think about, yeah. like that whole notion of why she assumed that identity, how like she assumed responsibility for like the idea of like being a daughter to parents,
yeah,
and living
yeah.
that life.
You find out that Vara took someone else's identity, basically, mm-hmm. like somebody else who is dying. The thing that I didn't get was she's like, she made me 3 promises, and one of them was not to hurt you, Nick Fury. And I was like, yeah. What? Like, did the dying woman know Nick Fury? Like, what was up? What's going on there? You know, anyway.
Vara probably
explained like who Nick Fury mm-hmm. was, but you know, I was like, why would dying woman who Nick Fury has never met care about Nick Fury? Also, Nick Fury was like, has said on the show, like, oh, I never was going to ask you. So he knew that it was a possibility that maybe she just took someone else's identity that wasn't dying, or, you know, like, which is its own weird thing. Anyway, go ahead, Patrick. What were you going to say?
Well, it's just that, you know, you have that layer of like assuming the identity of another person, which obviously we yeah. only get the inklings of, has clearly weighed on Vara. Like, she is her true self when Fury is gone. He walks in the door. She transforms into this you know, what did Fury fall in love with? Fall in love with, you know, all like attraction is some mixture of, you know, physical, emotional, psychological. And because of the nature of the Skrulls, that like untangles, like presents something like really interesting. Like, do we really think they've never talked about like the transformation or her relationship with that skin in that body. Like, I have to imagine that has come up, and they allude to that at the end. And it's just like, that's just such rich material for something that is, yes, it's like goofy shape-shifting aliens. But then, oh, right, like, there's actually a needle to thread here to say something really fascinating about the human condition and how we have relationships with one another that are like beyond just physical attraction, but what layer does that present? And the show has an opportunity to play with that and gives it so little space.
And what are the role, like, what are the ways in which we shapeshift for the loved ones around us and play a specific role for them? And if they love that version of us, do they really love us and so on? But to quote Nick Fury, guess we'll never know.
And that, in so many ways, it felt like, I feel like a lot of the conversations we've had about these first four episodes is looking at moments and wondering, will the show recognize what it has here and build a show around that? Or more fully around that.
Right. But we're two-thirds of the way through, and it seems increasingly unlikely now, right?
Increasingly unlikely. I'd be so curious to know how much of this tension existed in the conceptualization of the show. Like, there's too many smart ideas like buried under the stuff that doesn't work. And I was like, well, people, like, you know, shows are complex. Like, getting a show made in the Marvel machine is like, I'm sure an even bigger layer of complexity, and the shows do not seem to have any of the level of the sort of auteurship that like is granted sometimes to like the bigger productions, like a Ryan Coogler gets on a Black Panther and a James Gunn gets on a Guardians, where you're in the machine, but you can see the authorship there. And it really feels like so much of the television show is way more Feige
We have to get back to Gravik's next terrorist plan, basically.
Right? And it feels like the way you, like, Gunn talks about how he writes his scripts and works within like the ass that he's getting from the greater Marvel universe is like he finds a way to meet. I just feels like this is way more like comic book nerd Kevin Feige, like, conceptualized on screen, and it's like, whoa, what's missing in these television shows? Even as hard as it is to get that balance in the movies, like, is a lot of that. What is the voice of somebody here? And I feel like you can see that voice in those conversations. And then when Fury walks out the door, the show that I wanted this show to be is also walking out the door as well. And maybe it can still be like a fun romp at the end. Like, that's what I'm hoping for. Mm-hmm. But the more emotionally grounded, like, insightful look, I don't think that show is going to exist in episodes 5 and 6.
Hey, man, don't give up hope quite yet, because we're getting to the best sequence of the last few episodes. Fury heads to another confrontation with Skrull Rhodes. I like how Caroline Sita over at Episodic Medium wrote about this. She called him Scrody.
No! Boo!
We're calling him Scrodes. We're calling him Scrodes, okay?
No!
It's a rule. Okay. All right. Scrodes.
Don't break every time I say it.
Fury Scrody. Heads to another confrontation with Scrodes under the guise of making peace. In reality, Fury slips him a drink with a tracking device, which leads them to the planned attack on the president's convoy. Gravik unveils his new Groot-infused super Skrull powers, but the assassination fails and the president is rescued. In a bloody fight, Talos is severely injured and then eventually shot point blank by Gravik. Fury leaves the scene with the president, presuming Talos is now dead. So that brings us to the end of the episode. Gotta say, I think in general, the show actually looks pretty good.
Yeah, it does.
I think, like, the cinematography, I think Eben Bolter is one of the cinematographers, a Filmcast listener, if I'm not mistaken, did some of the cinematography, also worked on The Last of Us, very talented guy. Yeah. I think a lot of the show looks great. The attack on the president's convoy, yes, it's like a little bit silly because, you know, in real life, I don't know that it would be, quote unquote, this easy to attack the president's convoy. They generally like clear the airspace or whatever, but, you know, Skrulls have people everywhere, so whatever.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, I think the president would have much more backup and all that stuff. Like, if you've ever been in a city where the president visits, it's like a generally larger convoy than the one you see here. Right?
It grinds your city to a halt.
Yeah. Which I understand why they needed to have it like in the middle of nowhere, because that makes it more plausible. Sure. But I thought overall they did a pretty good job. Like, the action is like pretty good. It's, again, it's a little bit silly, but overall I thought this is like the strongest action scene we've had in the show so far. How did it work for you, Patrick Klepek?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. Less showy but more set PC moment is obviously Talos trying to break through the bulletproof glass. That was
cool. Like the idea that he's like physically transforming, and people are like they might kill him because they think he's a bad guy. That was like a nice tense moment.
It granted, even if like broadly speaking, I was like, I'm not really worried about the president. Like I'm not really worried about grabbing going after. But like again, like it's in many of these films, like you know that the heroes are going to solve the macro problem by the end. And so what makes them work or not work is like the tension in the moment. It's these micro problems along the way. And that one like felt tense and looked cool. Like it was the aesthetic working with the situation to produce anxiety out of the audience. And like watching him attempt to muster enough energy to break through this powerful glass while slipping away like this mask was really great, because up until this moment, the show more or less doesn't play with the notion of the power being, it's more of a light switch. It's on, it's off. We don't get a sense of, is this something they are active? Like, you know, you don't think about breathing. But then when you think about breathing, it feels really weird to think about breathing. How does their power work? Is it like that where, when it's working, it just switches and it's just on, and you can just go about your day in this new form. But the moment, you know, you're injured and you have to think about it, it gets like you have a much more complicated relationship with what is for them like a basic bodily function slash feature. And seeing that manifested in a storytelling element and in terms of what you're looking at, like was fantastic. Like it made me wish there were more moments like that in the show.
It was very cool. I think of it like flexing a muscle, Patrick, you know, maybe it's like they're flexing a muscle at all times. And they've just gotten really good at it. So Gravik kills Talos at the end of the episode. And
does he?
We will find out if it actually is true. I think you're right. If this is the end for Talos, kind of a bummer. I guess the idea is that he died like an idealistic Scroll, right? Like he's an idealistic
thing.
I do
think he's dead.
Yeah. Did you say that makes you think he's dead?
I do think he's dead. I think that the shot gave a more of a sense of gravity than when Gaia went down.
It would be pretty weird to have like the Gaia reveal and then have another Talos reveal. Like that just would be weird. At the same time, but here's the thing. I just said that. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we've seen four episodes of Secret Invasion, and in three out of the four episodes, Gravik ends the episode by killing a major character.
Right. And again, the Chaos Man, he just loves it. He just lives it. He just can't get enough of it.
So I'm not putting it past the show to do something repetitive is what I'm saying. Like, maybe it's like, aha, Talos is actually alive. Maybe Ben Mendelsohn was like, the only condition under which I'll join the show is if you kill me by episode 5.
He doesn't seem like it's why I appreciated his work in The Outsider, because there are actors that I think come into worlds like this. And I think you can kind of speak to comic book movies as their own sort of genre, like genre work. And some of them come into it because they want to like, it's good money, or they want to be in films that their kids can see. But like because of The Outsider, like that's why I was excited when he was in Captain Marvel. And then in this, it's like he seems like he's game for it. Like some people are
facetious. I'm being facetious.
Yeah. I guess I'm sad.
You want to defend Ben Mendelsohn's honor.
Well, not only defend, but also like, you know, like you want to give up, may come up with it. I'm giving the show an out. You want to come up with an excuse to bring Ben Mendelsohn back up. I'm not going to be complaining too hard. You can take, like, there's not much tension to work with to begin with. If you give me a couple more scenes with Ben Mendelsohn, I'm not going to be sobbing.
Yeah. All right. So that's the episode. Those are the two episodes. And I think I appreciated the action beats from episode 4, like pretty strong action scene, nice conversation between Scrodes and Nick Fury. You know, like there's some good stuff there. But yeah, a lot of missed opportunities, and a lot of times it feels like the show is playing with elements it doesn't fully comprehend or doesn't want to explore further. Patrick Klepek, any other topics or thoughts you want to bring up before we wrap up today?
No, even some of the other ones I was thinking of bringing up, we ended up
Yeah, we ended up kind of covering it through our main conversation.
Yeah, through our main conversation. You know, I mean, one that we that occurred to me in watching this, and I think you and I were messaging about it, was, you know, this show, unlike, I think, a She-Hulk or a WandaVision, like, doesn't really fully embrace or understand the episodic advantage of television. Episodic is a format. It is not, and we've seen a lot of this in, I'm sure you've covered a lot of this in your work, where frequently it feels like you're getting movie scripts turned into television because television is where the money is. And then you feel like you're just watching a movie chopped up into parts. And even though this,
excuse me, Patrick, did you not hear the part where I said Gravik kills someone at the end of each episode?
Excuse me, David. I'm sorry.
Structure. That's the structure of the show. Every episode, Gravik has a terrorist plot, and then by the end of the episode, he kills a major character. That's, if anything, it's the most procedural out of any of the.
I guess you're right, and in that regard, you are correct. But it just, whereas like in a WandaVision, it's like, okay, we're moving through time in each of the episodes, and in She-Hulk, it was a comedy, and like, and that was like sort of a bit of the week that she was working through. And I however you feel about that show, I think it understood the format, and there's nothing about She-Hulk as a show that I think would have been better served by being a movie for the story it was telling. And we're here. It very much feels, if they were going to go the television route, I wish they had been more experimental as we've talked and gone the more play-like feel, like go more conversational, go be a little bolder with the structural swing the TV brings you. Whereas I feel like by the end, we're going to get six episodes that, yeah, sure, it turns into 4.5 hours of stuff to watch or whatever. But could it have been like a 2-hour and 15-minute movie? Like, probably. And still accomplished much of what it's trying to do, which maybe is really just getting Fury to a place for the Marvels. And like, that will be a bummer use of this show if it ends up just being a chess piece move, given that at some point Samuel Jackson is not like, he seems game to do this as long as like Marvel will have him. So maybe we're not at risk of losing him. Like we've lost some other actors because he's not doing a ton of the action, and he finds it cool to be this character, but I don't know that we're going to get many more showcases for Samuel L. Jackson. And that's where the bummer part comes for me as I look forward to the next two episodes. I hope we still get some moments with him, because even if he's still going to be in this universe, it does feel like this is like kind of the get good, like kind of like the Black Widow movie was for Scarlett Johansson, which is like, hey, finally we're going to do a highlight piece for you. And you know, Marvel's, I don't think, has shown that they're particularly great at delivering on that when they finally do get around to giving what could be showcase moments for some of the bigger actors in their universe.
Mm-hmm. I think it's actually a best case scenario if this ends up impacting the Marvels in any way, because if you think about some of the other shows, WandaVision, you know, I remember watching WandaVision and being like, wow, I bet this is going to be a big part of the next thing. And literally it's dismissed with like one line in Multiverse of Madness. You know, what's his name? Doctor Strange shows up and she's like, oh, are you here about the thing?
I'm trying to bring my kids from an interdimensional gate, right? Clearly going to be an important part of the new movie.
No. Yeah, when I enslave that whole group of people, is that why you're here to bother me? He's like, no, I have something much more important to talk to you about. He's like, oh, okay, all right, well, in that case, we don't need to talk about that anymore. so I'm worried it's going to be like Captain America or Falcon and Winter Soldier, where like literally I don't, like, that show has no impact on the arc of Captain America. Like, if you, the next thing you watch, Anthony Mackie is Captain America. If that's what happened, like, that's like, oh, that's what happened at the end of Endgame. Why would I assume something different would have happened?
I don't want to spoil too much about, you know, what's been shown about the Marvels, but the little that has been shown in the trailer, I'm unsure of the timeline of where this fits. Nothing in the trailer necessarily speaks to me that it takes place after this, and that would be disappointing if like the Marvels is before the the arc of Secret Invasion.
Patrick Klepek's going to say, I spent 6 hours watching Secret Invasion and talking
to I would have done it anyway. I can be clear. Like, I am, like,
for
I
nothing?
Am a,
for nothing?
I'm a pig in a trough. Like, Kevin Feige, like, watch this. Okay. Like, I'll do it. I get something out of all of these. But I'm also honest about my relationship with them, which I think is, you know, I'm just, that's me maybe self-justifying. Like, look, if I record these podcasts with Dave, then it's okay that I looked at my phone while watching Secret Invasion. That's fine. I could have watched anything else, but I watched this.
Let's talk about a couple of these comments in the live stream room. But before I do that, I just want to mention again, Patrick Klepek is the host of Remap Radio, the writer of Crossplay, a new Substack that you can find at patrickklepek.substack.com. So be sure to check out Patrick's other work. Be sure to check out all the other stuff we're doing at Decoding TV, podcast.decodingtv.com. We talked about the Emmys, the Emmy nominations with Miles McNutt. We're going to be talking about Justified coming back next week. That's going to be very exciting. And many other things this summer. So be sure to subscribe and become a paid member at decodingtv.com. Get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and help to support the show. Because I pay all the people I work with, including Patrick. And it's your contributions that keep this podcast running. Decodingtv@gmail.com, by the way, is where you can email us and let us know what you thought of our conversation and of Secret Invasion. So before we wrap up, Patrick, let's talk about a couple of these comments in the chat. Daniel Falconer in the chat is saying the Marvels was delayed, so I think it probably takes place before Secret Invasion. Very possible, Patrick. Very possible.
Yeah, that does seem. Yeah, there was so much schedule moving around. And whatever, like, it's fine. It just, it goes back to an earlier point I think I had made in maybe the intro podcast we had done talking about the show ahead of me having seen it, that I think we will... The optimistic case for the future of the MCU is that between the difficulties of figuring out what storytelling to even do post Endgame, which I think is an extremely high bar to clear, in which if they just gone out with that, you couldn't have blamed them. But there was money to be made, and so they keep going. And that's difficult because of the kind of actors that were lost in that transition. And like, just where do you pick up the pieces? And then the loss of, actors like, literally dying that were probably going to be key figures. And then COVID happens, in which the schedule of all of these films has been all over the place. The optimistic case for the Marvel Universe is that we are sort of like plodding along until like the ducks can get in a row again with like my guiding light for a lot of this is Fantastic Four. I know the X-Men are important, but yeah. Feige himself has said the most important story to him is that family, those characters. And so I would be profoundly worried and then potentially disinterested in the future of this universe if by the time we get to that in like a year and change, they haven't found a way to get this back on track. Because it's like, how can you do continual storytelling if you can't tell it continually? You know, like I think even in an order, this still wouldn't be fixed. Like if this all came out in the order it was supposed to, closer together, I don't think it solves those a lot of the basic storytelling problems, but it's losing one of the main foundational pieces of all of this is that you watch this and then it helps you care about the next thing. And like so much of that has been lost in the last couple of years.
I don't think we're going to, I'm not particularly hopeful, by the way, that that's going to happen for a variety of reasons. First of all, as Lucky Dog Podcast says on Twitch, Iger said on CNBC that they would be pulling back on Marvel and Star Wars. No surprise after this year in media. He's been saying that for a while. And also, there is a massive writer strike going on right now. And as of this morning, or like by the time you're listening to this, there may be an actor strike happening. That is going to be, I think, not as disruptive as COVID, but it was definitely going to be up there in terms of how it impacts the timeline for these things.
But could there is a direct correlation in the slide of storytelling between when like the treasure box really got opened with television, right? In which, in theory, it was like, oh, characters that can't would would be punished for not being able to carry $1 billion movie. Just mm-hmm. won't get made. Right. And that, look, if we do it on television, we can introduce them there. Right. And then
we can do an
Agatha,
the Coven of Chaos on TV, but not necessarily
right.
as a movie. Right.
And I don't think that has gone the way that – I don't think that that path has worked out particularly well. I think there are exceptions. Like, I think Miss Marvel is going to be a star. Like, that actor is incredible, and I think she's going to be great in the Marvels, regardless of how that movie is. My guess is you will walk out of that film going, holy shit, like, she's great. I wonder if one of the best things that could happen to this whole universe is, like, look, just make less of it. Like, make mm-hmm. the ones that come out mean a lot more. Like, for the creators themselves, make the stakes higher. This movie has to be better. It has to mean more, because we only get to make X number of them. And maybe the costs, like, the budgets are literally going to come down as well, forcing you to do potentially different modes of storytelling. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but again, optimistic's case, like, because I want this stuff to be as good as how I used to feel about in the past, I do think that is a potential path forward of, like, look, maybe having unlimited resources was not the best path for this storytelling, and that actually being asked to do a handful of things as opposed to literally everything, it hasn't exactly panned out all that well.
I completely agree. Daniel, by the way, in the chat also says, I like how Scrooge was just casually sitting in his SUV during.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The attack. Gotta say, I'm a sucker for those kinds of scenes in TV shows and films where mm-hmm. like chaos is unfolding around a character and there's one character that just is not reacting to it. Very creepy. You know, and I think it was pretty well done in the show.
And the scene, we didn't get to talk about it, but all, like, one of my favorite scenes in the whole show is when he shows up. And I think this shows, like, what it's like to be in a Skrull adopting a human body.
Yeah.
He clearly drinks, Scrooge drinks a shitload of that bourbon, not realizing that that is going to maintain on their breath. And then when he, but they also clearly don't, they process alcohol differently, because also the character is not extremely intoxicated. And so when the president is like, what, get this man a coffee, like, what were you doing before this? I thought that was a neat window into the kinds of things the Skrulls have to account for, and also kind of an insight into, like, how does this function, because clearly adopting human form does not necessarily mean that you process alcohol in the same way. And so I thought that was a neat little aside about the relationship the Skrulls have with their bodies that is not something the show has spent a lot of time exploring.
Fair points. Final question, or final point. This, and again, we're broadcasting live at youtube.com/decodingTV, so be sure to subscribe to get future live notifications. Shareable Texas writes, my mind got tied in knots a bit thinking about whether Talos and Gaia make sense as relatives with their accents. And then I was like, why do Skrulls have accents? How do they have accents?
Well, I mean, accents are sometimes products of environment, right? So I could imagine if you
they're,
are adopting.
They're traveling around all the world. And, I have to say, it's so fascinating. You know, I have a nephew and you have kids, Patrick. And it's just like, it's fascinating to kind of try to grok how accents are formed, right? Like,
or forgotten, formed, right?
Yeah.
Like my wife, she spent a lot of time growing up in Minnesota. Well, she doesn't say anything like, she had that accent when she was growing up there and then lost it and adopted more of a generic Midwestern accent, having grown up around, spent a lot of time around Chicago. But when she has had, I don't know where the line is. I don't think it's a half a bottle of bourbon, like in this show, but a certain amount to drink, she will say the word Howis. And it's not slurring. She is just slipping back
in. Howis? What is that?
It is just a Minnesotan way of saying, like, a house. It is just a regional accent to her that is buried beneath the surface, and that when she's had a little bit to drink, it can kind of slip up, like it is just resting beneath the surface. And so I also find the relationship with accents to be interesting, especially because they're not, you know, they can be permanent, but are not always permanent, depending on like when it intersects.
And how severe, how significant the accent is. Right.
Right.
I remember there is this movie called The Imposter. Do you ever see that movie, The Imposter?
Mm-mm.
It's like one of my, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. The Imposter is, it's a documentary about this child who vanished. Right. And they don't know what happened to this kid. This child vanished. Then decades later, somebody comes back and they say, I am the child. I'm the child who vanished. Spoiler alert, the movie's called The Imposter. He's not the child. And he has a he has an extremely thick accent. And they talked with like linguistic specialists, and they said, like, there's no way that a child who grew up to the age of blah and didn't have an accent could then later develop an accent this like this. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, basically it's the first few years that are critical. And it's basically really hard to undo. If once you develop one. So anyway, some musings on accents for you, Shareable Texas, which I think is, it's the eve of Shareable Texas's birthday. So happy birthday there.
Happy birthday.
In the near, if I recall seeing that correctly. All right. That's it for today. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our conversation about Secret Invasion episodes 5 and 6. We'll also be doing weekly recaps of Justified in the near future. So yeah, that's what you have to look forward to here on Decoding TV and much more. Patrick Klepek, thanks for chatting today.
Thanks for having me.